Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by and welcome to the VTE Prevention From Quality to Safety Conference Call. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session. At that time, if you have a question, simply press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Tuesday, May 20th, 2008. It's now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Levanta McVicker with Premier. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Greetings from Premier, everyone, in Charlotte, North Carolina, where we help hospitals improve clinical and financial performance. Welcome to the program, VTE Prevention from Quality to Safety. We have participants calling in from all over the country, and we're just happy to have everyone on the line today. Again, this is Levanta McVicker, and I'm your host for today's call. Let me introduce our speakers for today and give them a moment to greet you. First, we welcome to our program Dr. Alpesh Amin, Executive Director, Hospitalist Program Medical Director, Anticoagulation Services, Vice Chair for Clinical Affairs and Quality Department of Medicine at the University of California, Irvine. Dr. Amin?
Thank you, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here on this exciting program, and we hope to hopefully stimulate some discussion. My background is I run the anticoagulation services, as was mentioned, and run the hospitals program and serve as vice chair for clinical and quality. I do health services or health outcomes research in the area of clinical care and quality improvement, and it's a great pleasure to be here.
I'd now like to introduce our second speaker, George Whitelaw, President of Strategic Marketing Technologies. George?
I'm really thrilled to be here. This is a very exciting topic, and it's something we've been involved in, both my company and myself, for a number of years. I began my career with Eli Lilly and Company and worked in a corporate group, and at that time we were looking at IT and how other people were starting to make decisions about the delivery of healthcare in addition to the physician. Today we're going to be discussing just a number of the tools that are being used, obviously using IT is part of that. So I look very much forward to our discussions and to your questions. Thank you.
So just to give you an overview of the format for today's call, I will be interviewing our speakers for the first 30 minutes. Your phone lines have been placed on mute for the interview portion. Then we'll open the phone lines for you to ask questions or make comments live, so please be jotting down your questions as we go along. We'll have help today from our Global Crossing operator, Don. So let's go ahead and get started. Dr. Amin, what are the key points in the Institute of Medicine's To Err Is Human?
Yeah, so back in the late 90s, the Institute of Medicine came out with its first report on To Err Is Human and looked at hospitalized patients and identified that as many as 98,000 Americans lose their lives each year as a result of preventable medical errors. And up to even 7,000 of these have to do with errors in prescribing medications, which we will talk about later on this call in the world of anticoagulation. And the cost to these errors has been estimated to be as much as $29 billion. And so there was a big push to try to deal with this, and which probably led to a significant amount of effort in the world of patient safety and quality. They came out with their second report a few years later called Crossing the Quality Chiasm, and instead of 98,000 deaths, started talking about, about 150,000 deaths due to preventable medical errors. And so the goal is going to be to try to differentiate how you as a healthcare system can deal with patient safety and quality and prevent some of these unnecessary errors in the broadest sense.
And can you talk about what the gap is in VTE prevention specifically?
Yeah, so as you become familiar with this area, the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality has identified that back in 2001, that one of the top 10 safe practices in healthcare is the prevention of venous thromboembolism. And a number of other organizations have identified prevention of venous thromboembolism as a safe practice in hospitalized patients. Folks have said that it is potentially the number one preventable cause of hospitalized death. And just to give you some sense of some of the statistics, is that there is on the order of 2 million DVTs that occur and about 300,000 deaths from a pulmonary embolism or venous thromboembolism. And this puts it at the third largest cause of cardiovascular mortality in the United States, behind acute MI and stroke. It also leads to venous thromboembolism leads to more deaths in the United States than the combination of breast cancer, HIV, and accidents and liver disease combined. So it is a significant risk that we end up having to deal with. And yet there has been a fair amount of evidence that supports the role of prevention, either from a pharmacologic or a mechanical prevention standpoint, in preventing DVTs or venous thromboembolisms in hospitalized patients. Up to 5 to 10% of hospitalized deaths have been attributed to venous thromboembolism, and yet, despite the evidence, which we can talk about a little bit more, there seems to be a disconnect in how we are doing in terms of preventing venous thromboembolism. And just to give you a sense of this disconnect, there have been several studies that have been recently published. There was in the medical patients, which have been attributed to cause as much as 50 to 70% of the mortality associated with venous thromboembolism. And in medical patients, we know that 70 to 80% of fatal PEs occur in non-surgical patients also. And so knowing these statistics, one of the things that has come out over the last year were two studies, one called ENDORSE and the second one called IMPROVE. And ENDORSE looked at about 37,000 medical patients and 30,000 surgical patients, and they found that that only about 40 to 60% of those patients were receiving prophylaxis based on national guidelines, which means that you could, the other way to look at it was that 40 to 60% of those patients were not achieving quality scores in terms of venous thromboembolism prevention. And if you look at the IMPROVE data, which compared areas within the United States as well as other countries, about 54% in the United States and about 49% received any form of venous thromboembolism prevention. And what we found also in the IMPROVE study was that low molecular weight heparins were used a lot less than other countries in the United States, and unfractionated heparin was used a lot more, almost three times more compared to other countries. And that gets back to some of the evidence that we can talk about. And my last disconnect in terms of achieving patient safety is a study that I was involved in using the Premier database, where we looked at almost 200,000 medical patients and about 80,000 surgical patients over a 3.5-year period between 2002 and 2005. And what we found was that about 60% of patients received any form of prophylaxis in at-risk medical patients in the hospital. But when you ask where they received it appropriately based on type, dosage, and duration, only about 34% actually received appropriate VTE prevention. That means that, you know, on the order of 56% of hospitalized patients that should have gotten some form of appropriate prophylaxis based on national guidelines, the American College of Chest Physician guidelines, did not get it, and it shows us that we have a huge opportunity to improve.
Thank you. George, I'm going to pose these next two questions to you.
Okay.
Can you briefly discuss why such a gap exists in VTE prevention, and why is VTE prevention such a major quality target?
Well, let me start with the second part first. It's a major quality target for the payer community because they've assessed that there's somewhere a cost of somewhere between $3 to $5 billion that could be prevented, and the clinical side, Alpesh has already reviewed. But I think what's important is when you look at the data, what you see is the payer is looking at approximately 50% of the population as being prophylaxed, even though the ACCP guidelines came out in the mid-1980s. So 20 years later, there is very slow uptake in their actual implementation of the strategy. The other part of it is that the gap exists in VTE prevention by the payer side is because they think that the wrong financial incentives are in place, that if an event occurs, then the patient would move into a higher-paying DRG or case rate, so that there's not the financial incentives to make the system change its behavior. I think on the clinical side, there are a number of issues. With some surgeons or orthopedic surgeons, there's some concern about bleed versus the prevention of VTE. There are also that these VTE events don't all occur in the hospital. They occur in the outpatient setting, so people are not recognizing the correlation between the inpatient stay and the VTE event. The primary effort, though, inside of this gap existing is there's also been in the delivery based on the IOM work that there's been an approach to healthcare which has not been a systematic approach in which all the participants are participating in the individual decisions around the patient. And it's how do you create that environment so that there's good communications and with the net result is that there's prevention of VTE because there are lots of checks and measures in place. The other element about this gap that really is, from my perspective, the driving portion of this is that as the clinical data is being put into claims files, the data is getting richer, and the Medicare Severity Diagnostic Related Groups is another level of improved data collection. And as you start to collect data, you're now able to look at performance. And the performance at this point has been looking at the process. You know, have you evaluated the patient, and did you do something? And downstream, we know that there are measures are coming that are going to be looking at outcomes. How many VTE events did you have in the hospital, and how many VTE events occurred post-discharge? So the IT side of the equation is getting more robust, and as it becomes more robust, there's the capability to identify the gap. And this gap is being identified in a number of areas. But VTE, I think we were talking just before the meeting, that by next year there'll be about 40 measures that the hospital will be using. Currently there's 6 new medical measures that are being approved by the National Quality Forum, and that's already in the Federal Register by CMS as proposed measures for next year. So that roughly 20% of your measures for your hospital would be VTE.
Great. Thank you, George. Dr. Amin, how are hospitals addressing this gap, and what are the potential challenges that may be encountered? Also, what can facilities do to overcome these obstacles?
Yeah, so let me also talk about what the hospitals are doing in regards to this gap. I think there's many hospitals are looking at this in different ways, but I think most hospitals are trying to address this from the perspective of first doing good risk assessment on patients that come into the hospital to determine which patients are at risk for venous thromboembolism. And I would say that if you think about this and if you look at the literature, the average number of risk factors that patients have for venous thromboembolism is somewhere on the order of 3 to 5, if not more. So, and the second point in that is that patients that do come into a U.S. hospital in 2008, I think it'll be you'll be hard pressed to find a patient that is actually not sedentary. And that's an important point because these patients that we are taking care of are complex with chronic multiple risk factors and are also sedentary in an acute stage of an illness that keeps them in the bed. And all of these are considered risk factors for venous thromboembolism. Plus, our patients are aging, and as the patient's age goes up, their risk goes up exponentially to a point where above the age of 70, they end up having an independent risk factor for venous thromboembolism. And obesity continues to increase in our patient population. So that's the first thing. So I would say that hospitals need to do good risk assessment, but they need to move quickly beyond that because most of their patients already are going to be at risk for venous thromboembolism in U.S. hospitals. So what other things that hospitals are doing are trying to use unique tools to help dedicate to the process of VTE prevention. So having an aggressive performance improvement department or quality department that takes ownership of this process, having a physician leader that can drive this process from a physician education standpoint as well as help develop a process of care. Developing a committee that focuses on national patient safety goals around anticoagulation or VTE prevention is going to be important. Setting up anticoagulation clinics for patients as well as an inpatient service could be important. And lastly, using information technology to help drive this process. And there was an article published by Kutcher and colleagues at the Brigham and Women's Hospital where they used their form of an electronic alert and showed improvements in VTE prevention. We at the University of California, Irvine, have developed our version of an electronic alert system where we've got 90%+ physician order entry already, which was developed, 7-8 years ago. And then on top of that, one of the things that we decided to do is since we already had physician order entry, we tied the concept of VTE risk stratification as well as ordering something around VTE prevention to the admission orders that are put in by physicians and kind of locked them in and said, you have to answer some questions around how you're going to do VTE prevention. It moved our rates of addressing VTE prevention within the first 24 hours of a patient coming into the hospital from about 30% to 90%. The other thing that hospitals have done is having a well-developed hospitalist program. That's a group of physicians that can take on ownership from a quality improvement and drive this process and be systems leaders. And then others have used forms or protocols or care paths to help educate. And I'd say lastly, from a quality improvement perspective, hospitals have also developed scorecards, which they take back to their medical staff and their nursing staff and others in the institution to educate them on where they are in terms of VTE prevention and where their opportunities are to improve. Some of the barriers that hospitals have had to overcome have been listed in the American College of Physicians guidelines around anticoagulation, which they publish every 2 or 3 years. And some of them include clinicians' belief that VTE incidence in the hospitalized and postoperative patients is low, which has been discounted by some of the data that's out there. Concern about bleeding complications and prophylaxis, and that is a concern, but we're talking about prophylactic doses, and we need to be aware that there is opportunities there. The concern about side effects such as heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, lack of awareness about the cost-effectiveness of prophylaxis and patient outcomes, as well as the perception that risk assessment might be a difficult concept, but we have found that it isn't difficult, and one ought to think about how to implement that in their institution. So hopefully that gave a pretty good answer to those questions.
Thank you. George, we're going to turn it back to you. Do you have a comment that you want to add?
No, go ahead.
Okay, great. What incentives do hospitals have to implement these programs that Dr. Amin was just speaking to?
There is a significant change in terms of the incentives that are being used by the payer community. I think one of the fundamental issues is that, as Alpesh just noted, is that you now have data. Well, the public now has data, so your performance with respect to VTE is on public websites. The first part of it is that if the skip measure is a part of your core measure, it's part of your accreditation for the Joint Commission. But the Joint Commission's accreditation is not a standalone anymore. It's now being used by health plans to evaluate the performance of your institution. I think probably equally as important is the new dramatics that's occurring within the hospital community. Back in the early 1990s, the Medicare program ran the 30-day mortality data for every hospital in the United States, and there was a human outcry, and it was attacked based on its methodology and some inherent weaknesses in the way it computed the data. It withdrew the program. Last year, the same AMI 30-day with improved methodology was published, and the leading hospital with the best score actually took it and ran with it as a commercial. And I'm sure all of you hear commercials on local radio programs for your hospital or other hospitals that compare yourself to the performance on the Compare website or the Quality Check website. In addition to that, the contracting people in your hospital are now some of them are now negotiating with insurance companies with respect to how they want to use quality in their evaluation of the performance and also their payment to your institution. And we've known with some contracting departments that if it's a premium hospital that's charging a premium price, it really can't justify it if it's an average hospital and its performance is being publicly reported as an average hospital. The other part of this is the consumer. Blue Cross Blue Shield Association, they were talking about approximately 1% of the population would actually go to these websites. And there's been a dramatic change in that in the last couple of weeks. Medicare reported that there were about 200,000 hits per week on the Compare website, and when they published the new consumer survey scores, it jumped up over 1 million. So people are looking at these websites, and they're looking at their ability to look at the quality of the performance of the institution that they may be going to. In addition to that, a number of insurance companies, as well as Medicare, is also publishing your DRG prices on those websites, so the consumers can look at the quality versus the cost of the potential out-of-pocket cost for them to go to your institution. That's also being used by insurance companies, and some experiments going on now with pay-for-performance, you know, are looking at tier copays so that the consumer may have a reduction in its deductible or its copayment to go to your hospital because you're a high-performing hospital versus another hospital that may be nearby in which they actually have to pay a higher out-of-pocket cost. And as a pharmacist, you know, in the prescription drug program, we've seen significant change in consumer behavior between the use of a generic product that may be a $5 copay versus a branded product that could be $25, and then a Tier 3 product that could be $50, with the majority of the people going to the Tier 1 and Tier 2 products. And that, there we're talking about a $20 a month difference, where here we're looking at could be in the thousands of dollars for a given procedure. The last part of this is that now that there's this robust data set, we're now looking at new pay-for-performance programs because there's an ability to not only look at the data but to risk stratify the population and then be able to develop, and I say the payers are able to develop a methodology in which they can apply either an incentive to pay, give more money to those hospitals that are high performers, or in some cases what they're looking at now in the never events is not to pay you for an event that they consider to be one that was preventable, as well as there's discussions about secondary indications where events that occur within your hospital, you will not be able to put into the system either a complication or a major complication that would move the patient into a higher paying DRG. So there are both financial incentives and disincentives to use economics to change behavior. And inside of that, Lavana, can I go on to the...
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
I think part of this also, with these financial incentives to drive it, it really goes back to some of the things Al Pasch was mentioning, is you now have to deal with the physicians, the nurses, the pharmacists within your institution, and also the quality improvement people are part of this process, as well as in many institutions, people in the C-suite are now involved because the performance is now public information. We have in some marketplaces where the CEO's bonus, a percentage of his bonus, is actually calculated based on the quality scores that are put onto the public websites. So what that does is it drives down into your organization some difficult questions. There is a variation in the SCIP measures, but there's clearly a variation between the physician measure and the hospital measure. The physician measure that was approved by the AMA process and then went through the National Quality Forum and is now part of the AHRQ program is built around the surgeons essentially saying we can't have a detailed, labor-intensive process for evaluating the disease severity of the patient or their risk for VTE. And what they chose is to say all of the patients are at the highest risk and they should all be appropriately prophylaxed. The difference is, however, is there isn't the granularity that the hospital has. So in some cases, you may have a physician who puts aspirin down to meet the qualifications that he's done something for prophylaxis for orthopedic surgery. Whereas your hospital, when you go into the specification manual that's published by Medicare, specification manual actually tells you that aspirin is not accepted. So you have some real questions inside of your organization to start evaluating how do you interface with all of the people that are participating in the process so that there is a common objective. And obviously the common objective in this is the prevention of VTE. But inside of that, you have different criteria that are being applied, and there's different criteria within each of the different surgical procedures. So the specification manual has that granularity in which your institution has to operate. And if I can step from there, with the SCIP data, now just a quick point, when the program first started, there was about 40% of the hospitals were participating in providing data to Medicare when it was a voluntary program. As soon as it became pay for reporting, and now it's at the 2% level, the participation rate is about 93% of the hospitals. So 93% of the hospital's data is available. There's now this public website to be able to look at the information. And when you have that much data and it's so robust, you start looking at other measures. And the Joint Commission started that process about 3 years ago, in which they were saying the first round was looking at the surgical procedures, and now it was time to look at the non-surgical procedures as well as some of the surgical procedures that were originally excluded from the first effort by National Quality Forum. And the Joint Commission process ended in December. And I must admit, I was somewhat surprised because I expected that these measures would go to the National Quality Forum for approval and then appear in the Federal Register by Medicare. Actually, while it was going through the review process at the National Quality Forum, Medicare published it in their last Federal Register, announcing that there will be six new measures for October 2009. The Joint Commission has already announced that when these measures are approved by the National Quality Forum, they'll be implementing them this year. So from a hospital standpoint, you're going to have six additional measures that you'll be implementing. And these new medical measures really are somewhat different in that they start out with two prophylaxis measures, but there's also going to be treatment measures and there will be outcomes measures. So that the kind of information that's going to be available about your performance around VTE. And just to give you an example, I had bilateral knee surgery, and I went into these websites, and I thought the first important outcome was to come out of the hospital alive, so I looked for the hospital that had the best or the lowest mortality rates. My second concern was about an infection, and so I looked for a hospital that had the lowest mortality rates and the lowest infection rates. However, when I talked to the surgeon about VTE, the answer was good. And my reaction was, well, I want something more than good. Well, what in fact came out of that discussion is frequently there is a discussion about quality, but it's in a qualitative sense. What we're talking about now is a quantitative. There is now hard data to start looking and analyzing the performance of your institution, and obviously for you, there's now data for you to look at the performance of the physicians that are in your institution as well as your nurses and your pharmacists. So you have this data, and you're now in the position to influence both the incentives that's coming to your institution by improving the quality of your institution so that you get more patients, you get better contracts with health plans, and you get better payment policies from the payer community.
Thank you, George. Dr. Amin, can you spend a couple minutes addressing the National Patient Safety Goal 3E and why the Joint Commission is now looking at the use of anticoagulants?
Yeah, thank you. I'll be happy to. part of, if you remember back at the beginning, I mentioned the ILM report and the fact that there was a significant amount of deaths from preventable causes, and one of the areas was medication errors. So the Joint Commission has come up with the National Patient Safety Goals, and the only medication area or medication category that is in the first set of National Patient Safety Goals is anticoagulation. And so in 2008, the Joint Commission has issued its National Patient Safety Goals with the goal of promoting specific improvements in patient safety. And the goal around hospital program 3E is to reduce the likelihood of patient harm associated with the use of anticoagulation therapy. And some of the strategies that they have is that there needs to be an organization wide, you know, defined anticoagulation management program to individualize the care provided to each patient receiving anticoagulant therapy. It needs to reduce compounding and labeling errors, and the organization needs to figure out how to do that. The pharmacy services within an organization, as they dispense warfarin, it needs to be they need to establish some monitoring procedures and follow those procedures. And there needs to be some approved protocols for the initiation and maintenance of anticoagulant therapy. All of these are important, and you know, in the usage of heparin, both IV and by some sort of infusion pump or low molecular weight heparin therapies, there needs to be policies that govern you know, lab tests and how you monitor levels and so forth. And these are all important from the perspective that the strategy of getting it set up is throughout 2008, but it has to be implemented by January of 2009, January 1st, 2009. And so this is a big deal because anticoagulants have always been in the top five areas of top five list of medical errors from medication standpoint. And so the Joint Commission is looking at reducing those. And in my opinion, this should be, even though it's focused on reduction of medical errors and is a process, it can be tied in with the concept of quality and VTE prevention and developing a program within the institution that ties in all of these pieces is going to get you, I think, a lot farther, but there's going to have to be a process that's set up at each individual hospital, and I would encourage each hospital to think about doing that.
Thank you, Dr. Amin. George, we just have a couple minutes left before we open up the lines for questions, but we did want to ask the question, if you could address, is there a systematic approach to both SCIP and the National Patient Safety Goal 3E? And then most importantly, who has a part in this process, and how can hospitals achieve buy-in from all responsible parties?
Well, I think I want to expand somewhat the topic. The area, first of all, the SCIP, I think now you have to include SCIP as well as the new VTE medical measures, the National Patient Safety Goal 3E. I think there's clearly recognition that there's a gap in care, and the recognition that anticoagulation is going to be one of those higher rated interventions, and so that ties into the greater use of anticoagulants and the need for using them safely. In addition to that, you have the consumer assessment of healthcare providers and systems, and this is an evaluation of the hospital's performance with the patient. It's a patient survey. But it's also an evaluation of the physician that intervenes with the patient, and it's also an evaluation of the nurse. And the AHRQ original research, what they found is that the medication was the poorest performing part of the survey system. And it's the area that brings the hospital down. So we have three elements now. We have one, let's evaluate the patient, let's give them medication. And the systematic approach is what if there is a mistake in that something is not ordered? What is the process that exists within the institution to have that double check being made? The other part is that your nursing staff is moving around from floors where they may be using treatment doses to floors where they're using prevention doses. And that becomes an opportunity for an error to occur. When that occurs, you have to do a root cause analysis. In some institutions, the root cause analysis is left to the pharmacy department, but they're not the actual administrator of the drug. And so you have to bring that team together, and that team has to be everybody who is having a hand that's touching the patient. And that becomes important under this new CAPS survey instrument, because everybody who gets into the room now is going to be evaluated by the patient. And I know of cases where clearly the communications about the medication were so negative that when the patient was being discharged after 17 days in the hospital with a blood clot, the only information that was communicated was about the low molecular weight heparin that was being distributed to the patient in the outpatient setting, because the nurse provided a kit to the patient. But the other medication information was not provided. Who has that responsibility? How is it communicated? And it becomes a lot of issues. And I think the concern that we find in many institutions is when you try to deal with it on a case-by-case basis, we're talking about 20-odd measures now, 40 measures next year, 70 measures by 2010. You really have to build that systematic approach so that people who have the responsibility, clearly the responsibility to improve quality of care, but the other part is not to have the responsibility to have a finger pointed at them, but that they are the causative factor for the event to occur. To build a team, we have to take a look at it and say it is a system problem and how do we fix it. So you know that some institutions are applying the Six Sigma approach so that they're able to deal with the systematic approach, so that if a nurse does have the responsibilities of recognition, that there's a certain amount of workload in which the workload gets high enough that the error rate starts to go up. And how do you address those kinds of issues? The other part, I think, going back to some of the earlier comments, when you apply, at least when we were dealing with General Motors, when they looked at the issue of the 98,000 deaths, they looked at it as being one Boeing 707 crashing every day in the United States. It's an event that's preventable. It's referred to as failure to rescue. And I think the systematic approach is everybody on your team does not want that to happen. It's now how do we find those system errors that are contributing to these problems and then being able to address them. Importantly, you'll also have access to data, and the data is really a very compelling tool with all of the participants. We have one hospital where they actually put the prevention scores or the performance scores up on the wall so everybody knew exactly how they were performing. And it didn't take more than a few weeks before everybody started to move up. And the other part is you've already done this. You've done it with beta blockers. You successfully have gotten beta blocker usage up to a point where pretty soon there won't be a measure anymore. So the same thing is anticipated here with VTE. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to both of you for sharing your stories with us. That concludes our interview portion of our program today. Now we invite everyone listening to ask our speakers questions or to comment on what we've discussed. So we're ready to take your questions. Don, our Global Crossing operator, will facilitate these questions.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to register to ask a question, simply press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You'll hear a three-toned prompt to acknowledge your request. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, simply press the 1 followed by the 3. If you are using a speakerphone, please lift your handset before entering your request. One moment, please, for the first question.
And while we're waiting for our first question, let me remind everyone that the audio file of our call, along with several reference materials, will be available on our website 24 hours after today's call. You can access these materials at premierinc.com/advisor live. Again, that's premierinc.com/advisor live. Don, do we have our first question?
Indeed. Our first question comes from the line of Ada Ivey from the University of Maryland. Please proceed.
Yes, hi. This has been a very, very interesting talk, especially at our institution with a very strong VTE prophylaxis committee. I have a two-part question. For Dr. Amin, do you have a sense that from a national safety standpoint, it's more important that physicians are compliant with choosing some kind of prophylaxis versus them actually showing some form of risk assessment? In our institution, we battle with whether to, in terms of education, preach prophylaxing versus preaching some form of standardized risk assessment for physicians to show that in our physician computer order entry.
You said you had two questions. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. So that is the first part. The second part is, if indeed it's important to show risk assessment, how does an institution where you have surgeons, neurosurgeons, shock trauma, and physicians from different departments that differ in their thought, in the sense that in our institution we have a disconnect where some of the departments feel they have a very high compliance rate because they deal with very high-risk patients, and therefore the act of actually showing a risk assessment seems to slow them down. So I guess that's my two-part question. If it is important to show risk assessment as part of either the Joint Commission or part of AHRQ or National Safety, how do you get other high-performing departments who feel we're very compliant, how do you get them to actually do a risk assessment as well?
Well, you know, I think what folks are looking at is the outcome, the end outcome. Are you doing appropriate VTE prevention in your at-risk patients in the hospital? The idea of risk assessing is the process of determining whether a patient needs to receive something to help prevent VTE. And that's something that is an internal thing more than an external thing, in the fact that, you know, whether you have to actually physically show it to anybody. I think what needs to be shown is that you're actually doing, you're achieving the outcomes that you need to achieve. Having said that, though, the process of getting everybody on the same page is multiple fold, I think. You know, people have the perception that they are actually doing something, but I'll give you an example. I got invited to give a lecture at a Grand Rounds at a moderate-sized hospital with a room full of medical staff, and I asked them, how many of you truly believe that you, on a daily basis, risk assess your patients and are doing something to prevent VTE? And more than 75% of the people in the room felt that they did it more than 80% of the time. And there happened to be a quality person in the room who actually was measuring outcomes, and for the last four quarters found out that they were actually doing it less than 25% of the time. So, you know, that's one disconnect that exists. And so the going through a formalized process of evaluating where you are, showing your data, and doing an educational process to improve those numbers is going to be important as you continue to move forward in doing risk assessment in your patients and achieving your outcomes in VTE prevention. Did I answer both questions, or did I miss the first one?
Yes, you answered them very well. Thank you.
I'd like to add comment to that. It reinforces with what Alpesh just reported. LeapFrog is abandoning process measures. They're leaving the ones they have in place, but their focus is on outcomes. The outcomes measures, they've seen significant results in looking at some of their efforts with CABG and PCI surgery and mortality rates by publishing the outcome results. Mm-hmm. And the question mark is that you do risk assessment, but that doesn't mean the risk assessment meets the criteria in terms of preventing the VTE event. And with claims files, it's simple enough to look at the number of events that you have within the institution or the number of events that you have 30-day post-discharge. And those are the things you have to look down strategically downstream.
Hmm. Thank you.
And our next question comes from the line of Bernadette DeHill with St. Joseph Baptist. Please proceed.
Hi. You had discussed earlier that some of the payers will probably start not paying for those never events. And I'm just wondering if there has been any discussion as far as instituting such measures for physician payment reimbursement along these events for those patients, say if the physician fails to order VTE prophylaxis and their patient does develop a DVT. Is there some kind of incentive for the physicians to do this?
Well, there's two elements there. One is that the PQRI program that rolled out by CMS this last year wasn't as successful as they had anticipated. I think they're up to about 120 measures now for physicians, but there's only three of them that they have to report on. What's going on, I think it was announced today, in fact, is a new program that Medicare is rolling out in which the hospital and the doctor will be paid in one payment. It'll be bundled together, and the intent is that if there is improved quality, there will be more revenues coming into the institution, so there will be a direct revenue sharing with the physician in the hospital. Obviously, to tie together a common objective with respect to quality outcomes. But I think what we see on all of these are clearly incentives. I think the other challenge the institution has is how do you communicate to physicians who aren't going to be participating? And I had mentioned earlier about a number of incentives. I know one hospital was able to take its performance data on the website and take one of their surgeons' data out of the data set so they could show him the impact that he was having on the institution's performance. And by having that kind of impact, it was also going back when consumers looked at the data, whether they would choose him as their surgeon or would they go to another hospital or to another surgeon. But you do have some information in which you can share, as you did with beta blockers, you can share with the doctor so that there's a common objective.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from the line of Teresa DiCarlo with St. Mary's Hospital. Please proceed.
Yes, I have a question regarding the SCIP VTE1 and the SCIP VTE2. My question is in regards to the time discrepancies. For example, the physician has 48 hours to order, you know, chemical or mechanical prophylaxis, but the hospital only has 20, in VTE2, only has 24 hours in order to answer it in a timely manner, and whether the denominator doesn't change. You know, at a different venue, I asked this question, and they said that they're two separate entities, but in fact, when they're looked at through SCIP, they are not two separate entities because the denominators remain the same for both. That's my question.
Okay, if I can, I'll answer the last part first. On the Compare website, they do show you the performance for both SCIP 1 and SCIP 2.
Correct.
And normally you'll see a drop-off between what was ordered and what was done, and then it's in terms of the hospital's performance.
Yes.
And the SCIP 2, the specifics in SCIP 2 are spelled out in the specification manual. But the question mark is this issue about assessing somebody but then giving them prophylaxis. And that's where the disconnect is. And also a disconnect is where the prophylaxis that might be recommended
It isn't the assessment part. It's they're asking if something's been ordered.
Yes. Well, the SCIP one is was there an assessment and was something ordered?
Correct.
All right. SCIP two is was it administered?
Yes, but the
And that you have 24 hours post-surgery.
Right, but SCIP 1, they have 48 hours to order it.
Yeah, but they can order it pre-op or post-op.
They can order it post-op up to 48 hours, but we only have up to 24 hours after surgery and time to implement it, and that just doesn't seem to make any sense.
I'm not sure what SCIP manual you're referring to, but it was my impression that the 48 hours was 24 hours before surgery up to 24 hours after surgery, not 48 hours post-surgery.
All right. I'll double-check, but I don't think so.
I will double-check as well.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
And our next question comes from the line of Daniel Hardesty with St. Joseph Medical Center. Please proceed.
Hi, I'm Chief of Medicine at St. Joe's, and we have been an SHM mentor hospital, and we've been able to go from a compliance rate for prophylaxis from approximately 30% to one of about 85%. However, we still are protecting patients to a much better degree now, but our documentation of that risk assessment is still only running about 25%. So here's my question. There was much discussion about the regulatory agencies, and it was my impression that the National Quality Forum and the Joint Commission was taking that big step back from mandating risk assessment, and seemed, the last time I saw something coming out of the National Quality Forum, they seemed to be less interested in the risk assessment. What is your sense of where we're heading? And I ask the question because we've been working very hard to push our physicians very hard to do the documentation, and if the Joint Commission and others steps back from mandating that risk assessment, then we could move forward a lot more quickly if we're just focusing on getting prophylaxis done and not having to expend so many resources trying to document and do audits and track back to individual doctors. So the question is, do we think the National Quality Forum and the Joint Commission is going to step back from mandating the risk assessment and just focus primarily on the outcome of do we give prophylaxis or not?
Well, Alpesh, you mind if I?
Yeah, go ahead, George.
I think you've asked a series of questions that are all interfaced. Number one, the most recent measures that are being approved by NQF that came out of the Joint Commission includes risk assessment. In addition to that, the proposal by Medicare in looking at value-based purchasing, they're looking at rolling out skip 1 and 2, so it becomes really important to your institution in terms of payment policy to improve both sides of that score, because the value-based purchasing is really going to be driven for the hospitals that are in the top 15 percentile, which will be getting essentially, depends upon the numbers, but approximately 55%. So we don't see that changing. Where we do see the change is on the private sector side that are looking more at just outcomes and not so much on the process measure. But that's still some time away before that's going to be rolling out. But the driver is to go to outcomes, but they're not ready to abandon the process measures because the overall performance of the process measures are still, I think, on average about 73% nationwide.
Okay, well, thank you. I guess I'll just keep working.
Yeah, well, it's a challenge.
Thank you.
And our next question comes from the line of Bill Brock with Texas Health Presbyterian. Please proceed.
Yes, sir. One of the questions I had was in our orthopedic department. We have an excellent joint replacement institute of very good orthopedic surgeons and have really very good outcomes of low incidences of both superficial and lower extremity DVT and no reported PEs. They're fans of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons' recent recommendations. They use aspirin and sort of multimodality therapy but don't qualify by the strict criteria of getting a heparin-induced chemo prophylactic agent on board within that 24 hours post-op because of their very real fear of hemarthroses and wound complications. It's hard for me to really take them to task because they do 100% scanning of their legs prior to discharge. They do venous duplexes. They have an incredibly low rate, and they're effective. So it's hard for me to beat them up just because they're not meeting a regulation, and I just wondered how you're approaching that in your institution.
Yeah, so are they doing any form of prophylaxis? Are they using mechanicals during the surgery or after, on even if it is on the opposite leg? Are they giving pharmacologic agents at the time of discharge for a period of time after discharge? Are they doing anything?
They give intraoperative heparin. They give aspirin preoperatively. And then about 24 to 48 hours later, will initiate either, depending upon the group, except heparin or at least oral Coumadin. They all go home on Coumadin. So, you know, from a final standpoint, they're managed in the Coumadin clinic. They are, you know, have therapeutic INRs. It's just they don't meet that immediate perioperative time frame.
Right. So, you know, you've asked a couple of you brought up a couple of points there. You know, the immediate perioperative time frame is going to, you know, obviously there have been people that have studied this and they have put some standards into place. And, you know, I would encourage your group to actually think about those standards from an evidence-based perspective. The issues around the aspirin as an example, I mean, you know, the Orthopedic Society nationally has come out with some statements about the usage of aspirin, but there's a number of other folks that national organizations that question those the usage of aspirin as an appropriate choice or an optimal choice, I should say, of venous thromboembolism prevention. And I would go back, you know, I would encourage that, you know, maybe there should be a discussion, you know, within the group of surgeons at your institution about what it may be appropriate versus what is the optimal choice given the choices that exist today. There's also been some studies that have looked at the time of giving anticoagulants, you know, in the perioperative period versus postoperative period, and certainly the earlier you give it, there might be an increased risk of bleeding, but if you wait, you know, for 8, 12, 14 hours later, the risk of bleeding may actually go down, and even if you wait for up to 24 hours, the risk of bleeding might go down. So, you know, I think you're going to probably need to think about all these different issues as you try to meet some of the national goals that that come across. And I would also say that it may not be enough to just look at intra-hospital rates of DVT in your patient population moving forward, because they with these never events and so forth, there is talk about potentially saying, okay, even though you might not have gotten a DVT in a hip or a knee patient in the hospital, you know, if you get it 2 weeks or 4 weeks out of the hospital because of not optimal preventive techniques, both in the hospital, perioperatively, as well as post-discharge, you know, there may not be, you know, there may be consequences to that in terms of the original hospitalization as well as any readmission that might occur. So it is going to be, I think downstream people are going to be looking at the continuum of care, not so much of what just happened in the hospital setting.
I'd like to comment as well. I am aware that AAOS made a presentation to the Oklahoma Quality Improvement Organization that's responsible for the specification manual, and that aspirin was not accepted for inclusion in the specification manual. However, what came out of that meeting was a project with AHRQ, who funded a study, and I'm not quite sure if it was Johns Hopkins or Tufts, in which they did an analysis of the AAOS study, or their guidelines, and they my recollection is they found for the prophylaxis of VTE that aspirin data or evidence was a 3A. So it didn't carry the weight, the evidence that Alpesh was just referring to. The other challenge you have is this quantitative analysis. We have perceptions of data, but when you look at the data, the Medicare program and some of the insurance programs are able now to follow the patient out for 30 days. And so there's frequently, at least we found in the New York State Department of Health data, that when they were looking at orthopedic surgical VTE rates, 14 days, that certain institutions brought in a lot of patients from other states or from a much larger catchment area than in the normal catchment area for hospitals. So patients were not coming back to the discharging hospital, but to a community hospital with their VTE events. And so the events appear to be much higher than what was anticipated by the institution. So and you have to tie that now in terms of your results to what's being published on the Compare website. So your institution, just as you described, is a quality institution, but quantitatively, your data is going to show that, that when it comes to VTE, the patients are going to be at a higher risk on the process measures. So the question I would refer is with one institution, what we propose is if you could cut your what you've probably already done is you've looked at your data for your secondary indications for those events that are occurring in the hospital, but also if their patients are being readmitted through the ER, looking at those patients to find out if they've been recent discharges.
Well, and we've done all that, and the issues, again, with the orthopedic patients are they have been very compulsive about follow-up. And, you know, at their 30-day follow-up in terms of actually rescanning legs in question and, you know, all of those other kinds of things before discontinuing, anticoagulation. And I guess my point is that these aren't guys that are just being cowboys. They're being thoughtful, and they're trying to minimize their perioperative bleeding risk and are very concerned about that as sort of the dark side of DVT prevention. And, you know, it's tough in their situation when they're doing 1,500 or 2,000 joints a year and have that type of their own experience based on, the procedure that they're doing and very compulsive follow-up to really argue with those kinds of results.
I think you're hitting a very important point. The dilemma is that in your institutional performance data, you need to get it published because right now, the only evidence that's supporting aspirin that AAOS has is essentially a consensus panel of experts, but not the clinical evidence. If you have the clinical evidence, then I suggest that needs to be published.
We're pushing them to do that, but it's
going
to be
interim,
a challenge.
In the interim, your Compare website data is and your Joint Commission data, and I'm assuming that you're in the Aetna insurance market as well as Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Yes.
And they're also publishing this data set.
All right, thank you.
And
we are at the end of our time today, and I'm sure there's more questions out there on the line that I wish we had more time to get to. I would like to say if we were not able to get to your question, please feel free to reach us with your question at advisorlive@premierinc.com, and we'll do our best to get back to you. I would like to thank Alpesh and George for your time today and doing such a great job, and I'd like to thank everybody for participating. Please check your email for a link to our web-based program evaluation. By filling out the evaluation, you will be able to request more information and suggest other topics for future programs. We would love for you to join us again and tell your peers about this series. Remember, Advisor Live is open to anyone at no charge. Take care, everybody, and goodbye from Premier.
And, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.